like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. It is Tuesday, March 26th. We've got a pretty full agenda today, and we're going to, as usual, jump around a little bit on the agenda. So with that, I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3409. And it appears I have a panel of legislators who would like to testify on this bill. So if we could have Representative Kenny Geyer, Senator Dingfelder, and Representative Frederick, please. And Bob, would you give us a brief description of House Bill 3409?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3409 defines natural hair care and exempts the practice of natural hair care from definitions of barbering and hair design. It establishes the Board of Cosmetology Authority to adopt rules regulating natural hair care, authorizes the Oregon Health Licensing Agency to collect fees and charges related to administration of natural hair care licensing functions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and I represent Senate District 23. I'm actually here with half of my district. Representative Kenny Geyer represents half of my Senate district with her House district. And I have to say, when I come over here, I forget how big the committees are because we've had people, and it seems like quite a bigger dais. Anyway, I want to thank you all for hearing this bill today, House Bill 3409. And this bill came to Representative Kenny Geyer and myself from a constituent, Amber Starks, who you're going to hear from in just a few minutes. Amber is an entrepreneurial young woman with a passion for natural hair care and social justice. It has been a pleasure working with her over the last year on this important bill. And this is a bill, House Bill 3409, that will create economic opportunities for Oregonians throughout the state who are interested in providing natural hair care services. This bill is actually a bill that reduces government licensing requirements while maintaining health and safety standards, something very important that I think we all share up here. And as you'll hear in a minute, Representative Frederick, Representative Kenny Geyer, Ms. Starks, and others will go into greater detail, but I wanted to be here today to share my support for the bill, to thank our constituent who brought it forward, and thank the representatives, good representatives on either side of me, for working collaboratively together to bring you the bill here today. And I'm going to have to run off in just a few minutes back to my committee, but I wanted to thank you all for hearing this and certainly urge your support of this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues on this committee. I am here also in support of House Bill 3409, Natural Hair Care. Oh, for the record, my name is Alyssa Kenny Geyer, and I represent House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. Natural hair care, including braiding, twisting, and locking of hair, is a traditional practice in the African immigrant and African American community. Currently, Oregon law requires that all natural hair practitioners acquire a cosmetology license, which involves hundreds of more hours in training and school in areas of hair care that are not related to the practice of natural hair care. There's a lot having to do with chemicals and things like that, dyeing, perms. This requirement is a barrier for natural hair care stylists, as well as a barrier for hair care volunteers. So currently, because it's not allowed, what happens often is that someone who wants to braid hair has to go to Washington to practice, or often they'll just kind of do it underground here. So this is really preventing a legal form of employment where it's very needed, both in terms of providers, who it's an economic development opportunity, and also consumers who want to have this kind of hair care. And it means if they do go across to Washington and offer this kind of service, then we're not capturing those state income dollars, tax dollars here as well. So the solution for House Bill 3409 would create a separate license for natural hair care practitioners that focuses on standards, specifically on hair braiding, twisting, locking, brushing, and combing, without the use of chemically altering hair products. There would be, in the this new licensing category, safety and hygiene requirements. And I really appreciate the support of the Board of Cosmetology under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency in helping look at some of those issues. This would remove the barriers, pave the way for more jobs and increased opportunities, particularly for African immigrant and African American businesses. We are taking a middle road by doing this. There's a lot of states across the country that are looking at this issue right now. Some have decided to do away with any kind of requirements at all, for instance, the state of Washington. We're following more of the kind of middle road that Florida and Kansas have done by creating this online licensing requirement. So I appreciate all the other people who are coming to testify on this and really urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lou Frederick, a state representative from District 43, and you might be surprised to see me here discussing cosmetology. It's not exactly something that I'm dealing a lot with, obviously, very obviously. But I spent many summers growing up with my grandparents who owned a salon. In fact, they owned the salon for 60 years. And it doesn't take much to bring back those salon smells. They were the smells of strong chemicals and heated hair. We're here to discuss natural hair care. It's already been pointed out that this involves braiding, cornrowing, extending, lacing, locking, sewing, twisting, weaving or wrapping of human hair, natural fibers, synthetic fibers, or hair extensions using the hands or simple devices. It's also important to note that what it explicitly does not involve, it does not involve the use of chemicals to alter the natural texture, color, or behavior of the hair. So what is the problem we're trying to solve here? First, training and certification for the practice of other fields in cosmetology covered under the law does not include training in natural hair care, and few salons offer it. Second, those who practice natural hair care have no need of training in most of the fields of practice covered under the current law. This bill gives natural hair care a definition under the law and charges the Oregon Health Licensing Agency with establishing rules for qualification and the practice of natural hair care. It gives natural hair care a legal home, and it gives consumers the benefit of the assurance that there are standards of competence, safety, and hygiene reflected in certification. Customers seeking this kind of service typically either travel out of state, as Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned, or find a person who works outside of the certification system. This bill doesn't take business away from existing salons. They typically do not offer this service. It brings a recognized field with significant consumer demand under the umbrella of regulation without requiring them to acquire skills and a certificate that are irrelevant to their practice. I should add that natural hair care practitioners really want this. Now, you're going to look at the testimony today and think that this is a black thing. That's correct as far as it goes. It's true that the products and tools commonly used to groom and style European hair are simply not appropriate for many other ethnic hair types. But there are a lot of hair types out there. I can look across this group here and see that. And there are a lot of techniques for making... Huh?
Those who have hair.
And those
who have
hair.
Getting rough.
I mentioned that several years ago. But there are a lot of hair types out there and a lot of techniques for making those who wear them feel good about it. It takes a field with a lot of history and tradition, one that requires skill and practice. It's often passed down from mother to daughter to in childhood, which is why I did not get it, by the way, just so that you know. And one with a growing consumer base and brings it into recognized status with all the consumer protection that brings with it. This is an important bill. In the last session, we put together a bill on for foster kids and the training of foster kids, foster parents, in dealing with the hair of different foster children. It was very important. This continues that effort, basically, to acknowledge the various issues that are related to hygiene and hair care that are in our community, and to make sure that we are acknowledging those things and helping people who already have this business going to continue it and continue it well. Thank you.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm glad that the Board of Cosmetology is here. You may be surprised to know that this may be the only bill this session I may have to declare a conflict of interest in.
Okay, I'm waiting for the
Here's the pitch.
Here we go.
And it actually isn't a joke. But I appreciate your testimony in bringing this issue forward, and definitely want to, you know, get into the weeds a little bit on this. And I think it's a well-intentioned bill, and certainly deserves consideration. So I'll be anxious to have further discussions on the bill. And thank you very much for your testimony today. Are there any questions? Holy mackerel. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the cost of filing so that you will have this restricted licensing?
Sure. Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. Thank you for the question. The Board of Cosmetology may be able to answer that better. They haven't come up with rules for this. They can answer what the current license for cosmetology for the full hair care is now. I can't remember, so I probably shouldn't say it. But our assumption is that it'll be greatly reduced, but it will be enough to cover running the program.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah. I've read the bill. And since it doesn't include use of chemicals and other things that are normally involved with cosmetic use and barbering and hair care, mm-hmm. I'm not sure why we need to be regulating this at all on a state basis. I mean, cities have business licenses.
And we will have the Board of Cosmetology up to answer some of those specific questions.
Great. I just would like to say that.
I'll just say from my own personal opinion, having looked at this and looked at what other states do, certainly states have gone in that direction. Our thought was that in cleaning combs, there's certain hygienic practices in cleaning combs, looking for lice, making sure you don't pull hair too much. There's certain safety and hygiene things that we felt was just this good middle road in talking with the Board of Cosmetology. And Amber Starks, the constituent that brought it to us, was, you know, very interested in wanting to be and wanting to work within the whole umbrella of all of the hair care professionals. You know, she's, I think, worked really hard to make sure that they're not trying to get away with other things that maybe others have worked so hard, put many hours, many dollars into, but this is a much more restricted scope. But that they do need to go through certain procedures. Of course, if they have their own facility then and their own business, they'd have to have a business license for that as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I did hear you mention something about online. Are you intending that they could perhaps get, as a food handler can, yes, something online to certify and go through all these hygiene things that you're talking about?
Yes, that is the intention.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
I don't know how many people are here for House Bill 3326. I believe we're going to carry that bill over till next, unless we have out-of-town people here for that bill, or as people have traveled that can't come back. Or is there anybody like that in description? No? I'll check with my committee administrator before I make that final decision. So up next we have Lisa Summers and Amber Starks. Or wait, Sam, excuse me. I got that right. Okay. I'll make sure I was looking at the right piece of paper. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm trying to do the green thing of not using paper and using my notes on my iPhone. Hi there, my name is Amber Starks, and I am really happy to be here. Thank you, Rep. Holvey, Chair, and committee members. Again, my name is Amber Starks, and I live in the district of Alyssa Kenny-Geyer and Senator Jackie Dingfelder. And I am here for the natural hair bill because about a year and a half ago, about 2011, November 2011, I decided that I wanted to go and help kids in foster care. I wanted to do their hair because I found that our kids were overrepresented in the system, and a lot of times they were with families who didn't know a lot about their hair. And so since I saw the need, I thought, you know, I can go do this. This is no problem. And I called And they said, yes, please come, because, you know, we get families who call all the time and say, you know, I need help with the hair. And they said, you know, pretty much, when can you start? And, you know, after talking, they said, we should check with the cosmetology board just to make sure this is okay. And I was then asked if I had my cosmetology license, and I said, no, I don't have a cosmetology license for braiding. And they said, well, unfortunately, it's against the law for you to touch anyone's hair if you haven't gone through 1,700 hours of cosmetology school. Now, for me, that was really, I mean, it really hurt my heart, because I thought, I have this gift that I can help our kids with, and I can't use it because it's illegal, but yet it's legal for our kids to walk around with their hair undone. Now, think about, you know, being a small child and not being in home with your family, and then not having your hair or your skin taken care of. Like, think about what that does to a child's self-esteem. And I really felt like I had a way to help them. And so after doing some research, I was told, you should call your rep, you should call your senator, maybe change the law. And I said, okay. And I called, and I was really astonished that both my rep and my senator said, I'll help you, because I had never seen examples in my community of people going to their senator or their representative and saying, I want to change the law. That didn't even cross my mind. So when I called and I was, you know, I was heard and I was listened to, I felt really empowered, and I said, yeah, let's change this law. Let's do something about this, because natural hair is about, for our community, this is our culture, this is what we do. And not only that, many women in our community are transitioning from the chemicals and the things that are often cause a lot of health issues. Think about a lot of the chemicals that get put on people's scalp, and a lot of our children experience that from a really early age. And so what I wanted to do is provide a source of empowerment for our community. I wanted to provide access and choice for our community. And I started this business, Conscious Coils, specifically to address that, to give women choice and access. And when I found that it was illegal and I had to find a way to do this, I ended up taking my business over to Washington State, where I currently practice, because that was the only choice that I had at the time. And so I really want to bring this to Oregon, and I really want to create a community around natural hair and a community around choice for women of African descent and for our children who are overrepresented in the foster care system. I want to give that to them, and I want them also to see an example of someone from our community going to our legislature and saying, these laws affect us. They affect our ability to practice our culture. They affect our ability to gain economic access and resource. And so I'm just really proud to be here. I'm really excited that you guys would even take the chance to listen to this bill, because it really means a lot to me.
Thank you. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Lisa Summers, and I live in District 22. Okay, hello, Chair Harvey and members of the committee. I've already given you my name, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3409. I support House Bill 3409 for several reasons. If passed, this would have a significant impact on both my beauty routine. I have textured hair that is both tightly coiled and thinner. Taking care of it requires certain techniques and knowledge that the average hair beautician does not have, because he or she is not exposed or taught how to work with ethnic hair. That reality significantly reduces who can do my hair. I live in the St. John's neighborhood, and while there are over a dozen hair salons in that area, not one practices natural hair care. The closest hair salon that does is over 12 miles away, which could take me anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half riding TriMet unit transfers it would require upon. Because I rarely have time to do that, I often ask a friend who lives in the neighborhood to come over and do my hair. The money I pay, of course, is not taxed. If this bill passes, the increase in natural hair care practitioners and salons would have a significant impact on both me and the countless other people I personally know who are unable to find natural hair care people to do their hair near them. Unfortunately, the case is even worse for Oregonians outside the Portland area. For I have a friend who lives right here in Salem who often drives to Northeast Portland just to have her hair taken care of. I must say once again, I am in support of Bill House Bill 3409, and I thank you for the time of listening to me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the questions for this group. I'm curious. So, you know, as Amber, as you were talking through that, it was, you know, I can appreciate your testimony. And so you found it pretty restrictive in trying to get a license to be able to do this. And, I mean, that's generally what motivates you, that the 1,700 hours was not all relevant to you. And right. So you're looking for this special license.
Right. And I'll say that I did call the Cosmetology Board, and I even looked for ways within the current law to find exemptions, because there are exemptions. For instance, if you work for a photographer or a theater company, there are exemptions to you being able to do hair without a license. And I don't know the specifics of, like, what the exemptions, what it says exactly, but if there were exemptions for those, I thought there must be exemptions for someone who's just braiding and twisting things that don't chemically alter the hair. And so I came down and I did the formal process of having a hearing and all that, and I was pretty much told that, you know, I needed to change the law if I wanted, you know, any way around this. And I guess my main argument against trying to go to school is that, you know, oftentimes the institutions don't have trained professionals who even are teaching the braiding and the twisting and the locking. And so for me, I'm thinking, so you want me to go through 1,700 hours of schooling that doesn't even address my hair? And oftentimes we're seen as a specialty. And to me, my hair isn't a specialty. It is as equal as any other person's hair. And so, you know, from the countless of people that I've met who are licensed, you know, they've said different things to me, like, you know, I feel bad that I can't even offer that to my clients. And, you know, can you teach me how to braid? Can you teach me how to do this? And I would love to be able to teach that. And that's another cool thing with this bill passing, is that I would be able to teach, you know, other licensed cosmetologists how to do this.
Right. And I assume you don't use chemicals in any fashion. You don't. The extensions, you don't glue them on.
Nope.
Or nothing like
that. And this bill would specifically address that. We talked about weaving, and because glue does chemically alter, we wouldn't use glue. We could use the sew-in method that, you know, you're sewing the hair around the braid versus gluing it onto the scalp.
Thank you very much for your testimony today and making the journey down here to give a shot at democracy, and we'll see how it goes.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Have a great day. Up next, I have Holly Mercer and Randy Harnish, I believe. Good afternoon, and if you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the interim executive director for the Health Licensing Agency, and I'll let Randy introduce himself.
My name is Randy Harnish. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Health Licensing Agency.
Yes. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I've only been in my position for about 4 months. I was formerly at the Board of Nursing as their executive director, so I've been on a somewhat steep learning curve. But this was an effort to work through some of the, shall I say, challenges we've had around this issue, and I think it's been around for a while. What we did is work with Representative Kenny Geyer's staff and Legislative Council and went through some of the specifics about actually creating a license, a specialized license for this type of practice. And as I've listened to the testimony, I leaned over to Randy and I said, now another option would have been to exempt them out of hair design, because we had an Attorney General's opinion that under the definition of hair design, then this type of practice would be included, and then we started down this journey. So that's how we ended up in this regulatory effort. Your question about fees. Generally, our fees are run in about a $35 range for each field of practice. The board would have to establish that going forward. But we tried to define natural hair care. We tried to define what it isn't and what it is. And the rest of the story will have to be through the rule process. But we are here to commit that the board and our agency will work through any issues that, you know, come forward, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. I know you've got a very full schedule today, so.
Thank you. And do you have testimony as well, or you're just long to answer questions?
Chair Holvey, I'm here basically as backup, so I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
So, Representative Thatcher.
Well, I'm with Representative Richardson. I wish we didn't even have to, you know, mess with having a new license and all that. But if we're going to go down that path, it is certainly an improvement over what is now. But I want to make sure, I didn't see where it said online offering of class. Is that your intention to offer some sort of a, like a food handler's license, be a hair handler's license, if you will, online?
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, I'll turn to Randy for the answer for that question since he's been involved in the implementation.
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, the Health Licensing Agency has begun to offer some licensing courses and licensing online. And so I know that was one of the options that we've discussed in order to make this as accessible and easily obtainable as possible.
And I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. And also, I had concern that we had testimony earlier about I think Amber said she wants to go help these foster kids out. To get a facility license, does that mean that she would then not be able to travel and do, you know, volunteer her services wherever?
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, we offer what's called a freelance license. It's kind of an endorsement to a license. Generally, a license is attached to a facility, but we have an option that's available to all of our cosmetology licensees now that would allow them to travel from site to site. So that is that's available.
And follow-up, what would be entailed in obtaining one of those?
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, it's just an application and an annual fee.
Oh, another fee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm curious, when was the last time the educational materials have been updated for the Board of Cosmetology?
Chair Holvey. I'm sorry. You mean generally updated?
Yes. The educational materials.
I actually don't have the answer to that, but I can get that for you.
I only speak because I am very curious as to the relevancy of the current educational requirements from the Board of Cosmetology. So I'd like to have you follow up with me on that as well.
Chair Holvey, we absolutely will provide that information.
Thank you. Under this special license, will there be educational requirements? Are they able to cut hair?
Chair Holvey, no, that was specifically excluded. It's merely the manipulating the hair. And then there is some language in the bill that talks about trimming the extensions and the pieces that would be woven in, but not specifically.
So trimming, they would be cutting and using scissors, essentially?
Chair Holvey, to my understanding, it would merely be the trimming the extensions and the mm-hmm. pieces
when
that would be
off
added
the hair.
Into the hair.
Understand. Okay, that's kind of what I wanted to know. I appreciate your testimony tomorrow or today, and maybe you can follow up with me on the educational requirements for the Board of Cosmetology.
And Chair Holvey, just are you saying generally for all fields of practice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I'm just curious how often they've been updated and how relevant they are. The relevancy is an issue that is not only talked about in this bill, but I think is of general concern to cosmetology.
Chair Holvey, just for clarification, if I may, is that through the career schools or is it through our testing that you're concerned about?
Both.
Thank you, sir.
I believe your testing is geared towards the career school educational materials.
Correct.
So that's what I'm curious about.
We will check into that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And before they leave, I would like to just reiterate the importance of maintaining this as an easy and inexpensive thing to do. I mean, when a hair worker can't get the training from the trainers because they don't know how to do this specialized thing, they're not using chemicals or anything, it should be as simple and as inexpensive as it possibly can make it, and certainly online would help make that more convenient.
Yes, sir.
And certainly I appreciate that. One of the reasons I ask, because I am curious whether the current educational materials cover braiding, for example. And I'm guessing they probably do. and it's part of the educational requirements for cosmetology licenses in general. Although it's not specific to the natural hair care that's been discussed today, but anyway, I just want to, you know, get a follow up on the relevance of the educational requirements in general.
We absolutely will provide that, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, we have. Is that a mistake? Oh, Steve Buckstein. Forgot, left one off. And Ty Schwafferman. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Ty Schwafferman, and I work with the Urban League of Portland. And you can probably see we have members from the Urban League here representing in support of the natural hair care bill. And I'm just so glad that we're talking about hair in the way that we are today, because this is a culturally specific approach to hair care. From my experience, just going to cosmetology schools to get my hair done just down the street, you know, I always ask them, you know, are there trainings for, oh, she just wants to take a picture real quick.
You're welcome. If you could wrap up your testimony.
All for a picture? I wouldn't trade that off. I wanted to just say that I always ask the folks who are going through the trainings at the schools whether they've had the opportunity to get trained in natural hair care, or if they've been trained in, you know, Afrocentric styles of hair care. What they basically answer to me is, you know, they call it ethnic hair. And it's a general term used within the cosmetology schools. And there really isn't a required amount of time that they have to dedicate to ethnic hair. It's rather a, sort of an elective. You know, it's an other option. And many of the times what the students will do is actually teach each other. And those are learned practices that have been passed down from generation to generation to generation from their, you know. And so these aren't practices that are really taught within schools, the top your mom teaches you, you know. So this bill does not address the college curriculum. It's totally separate from that. And so I just wanted to make that clear to everyone. We're not asking to change the college curriculum whatsoever. We're specifically asking for an alternative option for natural hair care practitioners. So I wanted to just make that very clear. And I want to also talk about the braiding aspect, because there's braiding, you know, from what you may think of like French braiding, but then there's also like cornrow braiding, and there's other styles like that. So there's other types of braiding that many natural hair care stylists will use. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Portland. And I'm also here to support HB 3409, although, as a couple members of your committee mentioned, I wish it would go farther, but I think it's a good step in the right direction. I submitted to you online a quick point, short commentary that one of our summer interns did last summer when Amber Stark's situation came public, when we saw it in the paper. And it's an issue that we've been interested in and talking about theoretically for a number of years in Portland and in Oregon. And we realized, I think we knew, and I think a lot of people didn't know, that it was practically impossible for people with her skills to practice those skills to earn a living in Oregon because of the regulations. The last data that I found is that 11 states already exempt braiders. They don't have a license like you're talking about today. They're simply exempt from cosmetology licensing. And that includes our neighbors to the north and south, Washington and California. In Washington, it took a lawsuit, which was decided in 2005 by by the public interest law firm Institute for Justice, who we've worked with on some other occupational licensure issues, challenging the state's licensing and winning in court to overthrow those regulations so that, again, as I understand it, Amber is practicing in Vancouver now. She wouldn't be able to even do that if that lawsuit hadn't been successful in 2005. Oregon is one of just seven states that I found that actually impose licensing requirements on natural hair braiders. 22 states are actually silent on it, so, and depending on issues and things that come up, are dealt with, I guess, on a case-by-case basis, but they don't have specific licenses or specific exemptions. I think reasonable people can disagree about what professions might require some form of state licensing, but in America, the right to earn an honest living should take precedence over the need for the state to regulate everything. It should also take precedence over an industry's desire to keep upstarts or new competitors out, which I think is part of the problem here. It happens with a lot of occupations that the people that are already in the industry don't like newcomers, and they basically go to the legislature and get a law or get a license that keeps others out, that raises prices and actually hurts consumers. And you're the Consumer Protection Committee, so you're not the Industry Protection Committee, so I'm hoping that in approving this bill, or something that I would hope would go even farther, you'd be allowing honest people to earn an honest living, helping consumers and new producers generate prosperity and wealth in Oregon. So I thank you for looking at this bill.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, have a great day.
Could I just add one more note?
If it's in within 15 seconds.
15 seconds. All right. Thank you, Chair Holvey. I just wanted to add one last thing, and I just want to say I'm very happy to be nappy.
That was worth it. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3409. And House Bill 3326 will be carried over. So if you're waiting for that bill, it will be carried over. We are also going to carry over House Bill 3070. So if you're here for House Bill 3070, we'll carry that over.
Most of them are loose, actually.
Oh, are they?
Most of them are loose. But Amber's fine.
Got it.
I love Amber.
Very articulate, neat lady.
Yeah. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2823. Bob, give us a brief description on House Bill 2823.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2823 establishes requirements for association accounts of planned community homeowners associations and condominium unit owners associations. Requires independent audit of financial statement of association with annual assessments of $500,000 or more. Clarifies requirements for management of funds of association. Requires certain insurance coverage to be obtained for the association and specifies individuals who may be association account holders.
Thank you. And up first, we have Karen Smith. And does Lori Skillman want to come up at the same time? Good afternoon. So we're going to switch from hair care. Something about real estate, I'm guessing. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Who would you like to go first?
Somebody.
Oh, go ahead. My name's Laurie Skillman. I'm the land development manager for the real estate agency. I review and approve condominium filings, and that's my expertise on this particular bill. I'm testifying as to the Dash 1 amendments. On behalf of a diverse stakeholder group that's informally called the Joint Working Group, the stakeholder group has roughly 30 members from three separate groups and addresses condominium and planned community issues. This bill is specifically about homeowners associations and unit owner associations. This group includes attorneys for developers and for associations, title insurance companies, accountants, community association managers, and people who work with associations. And there's a complete list of the whole group attached as Exhibit B to my testimony. I provide subject matter expertise and technical assistance to this group and worked on this legislation with the group as a member of that group. The real estate agency who I work for does not specifically oppose or support this legislation because this is from the work group. The purposes, there are two purposes of these Dash 1 amendments. One is to safeguard association funds and minimize the risk of loss, and the second is to clarify allowable association investments and to allow association accounts to be held in broker-dealer firms. As to the first purpose, to safeguard funds and minimize risk of loss, last June in 2012, roughly 30 homeowner associations and condo associations in Portland found that a community association manager had embezzled between $1.2 and $2 million worth of association funds. This is an alleged embezzlement, I need to say. So the joint working group created a subcommittee to look at ways that we could strengthen the laws to minimize the risk of loss to associations and to safeguard those funds. So there are three specific pieces in this legislation that address that. The first is to require associations to hold fidelity and crime insurance. This is insurance to protect against dishonesty, embezzlement, and theft by not only board members and directors, but bookkeepers, third-party association managers that would deal with these funds. The second piece is that only owners, lot owners or unit owners, would be able to access and be on association accounts. They're the only ones that could sign the checks, commit the funds, buy the securities, and so on. In this case in Portland, all these associations, all these 30 associations, had completely turned over their checkbooks, their authority on their accounts to this manager. And, you know, a lot of community associations don't want to deal with that and have a third party deal with that. So this requires them to do that. If a board chooses, they can adopt a resolution to turn it over, but that would be a very specific resolution by the board to do that. Or they could do it on a very limited basis. And the third piece is to require audited financial statements for really large associations. We currently require a review of financials on an annual basis for all associations that have annual assessments between $75,000 and $500,000. This would only deal with associations with $500,000 or more in annual assessments and require them to have those audited. And we think that those three things would be the great safeguards to put in place for association funds. The second purpose of the bill is to look at association accounts and how they're held. Currently, they're held only in banks, only in FDIC insured accounts. Ms. Smith and representative from a brokerage firm came and spoke to the group and wanted to expand the list of allowable investments and to also allow associations to put their monies in broker-dealer accounts. So the group looked at it carefully, looked at the types of investments they had, and this is also within this context of the current economy and also this great loss of funds. So the group took a pretty conservative approach on this. And there are five things that they decided on. First is just to make some definitions for operating and reserve accounts and what they can do. The second is to define the investment objectives for associations as to preserve capital and to provide for liquidity so that when the funds were needed in those reserve accounts for the roof that needs repair in 30 years, that those funds would be available and in a liquid state. The third was that we decided that reserve funds, which are the large funds that fund major repair and replacement for up to 30 years for an association, that those funds could be held with a security, Oregon licensed securities broker-dealer firm. and those are insured by SIPC. We also put in a provision that all funds had to be held in accounts at an amount that they'd be fully insured. And there was an issue that Ms. Smith brought up that currently there's a definition. It says that association investments may only be in obligations of the U.S. government. They felt that that was unclear. They wanted to allow mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The group felt that that was too risky for these groups, and so we defined that as investments that were backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, notes, bonds, and bills. And finally, we, because some associations may have not clearly understood the provisions of the current statute, which the group thought was clear, we put in a process that if investments are held by an association in the time the bill is enacted that are non-conforming investments, they could hold on to those investments until they were sold, at which time they would have to be reinvested in conforming investments, and that we wouldn't allow what's called rollovers. If you have a bond that matures and typically you just roll it over into the same type of bond and so on, we wouldn't allow that. That would be considered a sale of a security. So happy to answer any questions you have about any portion of the bill.
I think we'll listen to the rest of the testimony first.
Sure.
And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Thank you.
Thank
and
you.
And try not to repeat what she's just told us, it sounds like she's covered everything almost. But
she did. She did very nicely. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Karen Smith. I have a company called Resort Resources that's been operating in Bend, Oregon since the early 90s. I've been involved with planned communities, working for both homeowner associations as well as developers since the mid-80s. I am here at the direction of and at the request of six different homeowner associations. You can see them listed in my written testimony. They range from small to large, let's put it that way. And collectively, they represent quite a large number of members, over 9,000. And I'm only going to be offering testimony for this group on the last point that Ms. Skillman just covered, which is the reserve fund investments that are allowable by the current law and proposed for being allowable under these under House Bill 2823 as amended. The group felt, actually, with the last law change, which took place in 2009 and became effective in 2010, that the restrictions on investment of reserve funds basically was too restrictive on associations, and it limited investments to obligations of the U.S. government. Not only was that unclear, it seemed to be unclear as well as too restrictive. These associations have been successfully, responsibly investing in mortgage-backed securities. One of them goes back to 1985. And they would simply like to be able to continue having the ability to make proper, prudent, fiscally responsible decisions with regard to their reserve funds. The definition that they're seeking would go beyond simply limiting to U.S. Treasuries, notes, and bonds to include the investments that have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And Ms. Gilman mentioned Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those are government-sponsored enterprises. They would like to have those also be included, but Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed securities do have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Second point, if it is reasonable and appropriate to include in statutes, and that's your business, probably not mine, to include investment objectives. You know, only having preservation of capital and maintaining sufficient liquidity seems to be lacking a third necessary definition, especially with regard to investment objectives. So we would propose that a third leg of that stool needs to be added, and that would be to earn investment income, given the objectives stated in A and B. The third point, and by the way, this homeowner association group greatly appreciates the work that Ms. Skillman has done along with her colleagues in this condominium HOA working group. They have done a lot, and they have a tremendous amount of experience and go back to the 70s, I think, or maybe even earlier. I was around in the 80s. So we appreciate that. The SIPC insurance is different than FDIC. There is a limitation that's going to be $500,000. And the way that would work, $250,000 would cover any cash deposits with the broker-dealer firm, and up to $500,000. It covers missing, taken investments. And what some of these associations are going to be dealing with then is having to place multiple reserve fund accounts with different broker-dealers, which is not necessarily in the best interest of managing their reserve fund investments. We believe that the SIPC insurance is appropriate. It's necessary for that broker-dealer firm to have, but that the $500,000 limit may be problematic and create management challenges for some of these larger homeowners associations. And in closing, we fully respect the concerns that Lori explained and expressed with regard to homeowners associations and potential for embezzlement. We also think that volunteer directors don't necessarily equal incapable, not capable. Volunteer directors, there's many of them out there that are very capable, experienced business people, and they should be allowed the opportunity to make fiscal, reasonable fiscal decisions for their associations. And we would ask for that opportunity via some amendments to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, we have Ron Belosh.
Belosh.
David Schwint and Tim Martinez. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and try not to reiterate points already made, I would appreciate that time saving.
Of course.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey and members of the committee, my name is David Schwint. I'm a certified public accountant and licensed in the state of Oregon, and a reserve specialist licensed by Community Associations Institute, which is a national trade organization serving the educational needs of association boards of directors. My firm, Schwint & Company, currently provides audit, review, tax preparation, reserve study services to over 500 associations in the Pacific Northwest. I am here today representing the Legislative Action Committee of the Oregon Chapter of Community Associations Institute. This committee is in favor of House Bill 2823-1 amendments, and I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Up next.
Thank you. I'm Ron Belosh.
And you can move back from the microphone just a little bit. Thank you.
I own a property management company that manages condominium homeowners associations for the last 32 years. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon and Washington Community Association managers. And simply put, I'm here to speak in favor of the House bill. And the only concern we've ever had on the investment is just making sure associations are not risking their principal investment. So if there's any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez.
Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I won't repeat what some others have said. Our only concern with this bill, I think, is really well summarized by David Tapman's letter to you of March 6th, which is in your materials. I think the committee needs to really understand that the insurance, the SIPC insurance, is not equivalent to FDIC. It is a different animal, and the committee should be aware of that. Having said that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Bob, we have that David Tapman letter in our materials in OLIS.
Mr. Chair, it is available in OLIS, yes.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure.
So I found it.
Any questions of this panel? Not seeing any at this point. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And no one else signed up for House Bill 2823. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2823. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2667. Bob, remind us of House Bill 2667, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2667 is the bill that creates a task force on procuring through small and local businesses. The committee will recall that on March 21st, we adopted a -1 amendment, which clarifies the criteria for appointment of members, or removes the requirement that the task force evaluate whether procurement decision may be made based on greenhouse gas emissions, requires that the task force report findings such that impact contracting practices on certain categories of businesses and individuals may be understood. The measure has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued, Mr. Chair.
And the amendment to this bill?
The -1 was adopted at our meeting on March 21st, and I should note that the bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And thank you. The fiscal and revenue impact statements are ready.
Yeah.
Representative Lively.
Okay. Chair Hovey, I move that House Bill 2667 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2667 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on this bill. Not seeing any discussion. So, Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega-Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2667 is passed. On to Ways and Means, and with that, I'll close work session on House Bill 2667. Open up a work session on House Bill 2370. Bob, give us a reminder of what is contained in House Bill 2370, please.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2370 requires certain additional information to be posted on the state transparency website related to public meetings, administrative rules, and contracts. The committee will recall adopting a -1 amendment to this measure on March 21st, which clarified that agencies shall provide links to the Department of Administrative Services for posting, clarifies that public bodies may request to have link added to the transparency website, and allows the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission to suggest additional links, as well as specifying reports regarding properties an enterprise zone subject to the posting requirement. The measure has no revenue impact. And let me just verify that we have the fiscal statement on the amended measure. There is a minimal expenditure impact on 2370-1, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey.
Representative Lightly.
I move House Bill 2370 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Very good. Representative Lively moves House Bill 2370 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the motion. Not seeing any discussion. Samantha.
Representative Dorsey.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Teagart.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 2370 is passed to Ways and Means Committee. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2370. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2931. Bob, give us a reminder of House Bill 2931.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2931 creates a deferred maintenance elimination fund and authorizes state treasurer to issue bonds or certificates of participation to fund state facility maintenance, directs Department of Administrative Services to undertake additional work related to this. The committee on March 21st adopted a -1 amendment which exempts the State Parks and Recreation Department, the Oregon University System, and public universities from this measure. A revenue statement has been issued and a fiscal statement has been issued on the amended bill.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2931 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2931 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I once again feel that it's inappropriate for us to be expanding bonding to provide for deferred maintenance when deferred maintenance is to be a part of every budget. And by doing so, we're essentially rewarding those agencies and directors and programs that have chosen to spend money that should have been used to maintain their buildings and facilities when others that were more prudent would utilize allocated funds to do that, and now we're saying those of you that didn't do that, we're going to reward you by borrowing money. Taxpayers have to pay for it, and we'll do that deferred maintenance through borrowed money. I think that's inappropriate, and I'll be a no.
Thank you. I appreciate your position on that, and you know, I did consider that position as well. And
so you vote with me?
No, I won't. As we do use bonding for all sorts of construction projects, and recognize that agencies are sometimes so short of funds to address their missions that deferred maintenance oftentimes falls away as being unnecessary. And year after year of this happening seems to have put our assets as a state at, you know, in a deteriorating state, and I think becomes a real issue for us. And so I think this proposal of being able to use bonding is in this regard will actually save the state its asset value long term.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to also mention that this does resurrect the use of certificates of participation, which were never intended to be utilized in this way, but merely as a way to circumvent the standard bonding procedures and vehicles that are normally utilized by the state.
And not that we're having a conversation that we haven't had, but thank you, and I appreciate that too, and I do recognize that the certificates of participation are not normally used for this kind of bonding. However, it was thought that this bill, though, wouldn't it wasn't likely that they would use certificates of participation, but in the future you never know, so they didn't really want to limit it and didn't figure it really hurt too much, but maybe we'll revisit that at some point if that seems to be an issue, which I don't think it will be. So I do appreciate your points of view on this, but I do intend on moving the bill forward. So Samantha, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
President Kenny Guyer?
Aye.
President Smith?
Aye.
President Thatcher?
Aye.
President Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
No.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2931, having received the required votes, is passed with reference to Ways and Means by reference. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2931. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3160. Bob, can you give us a brief description of House Bill 3160, please?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3160 eliminates the exclusion of insurance from the definition of real estate, goods, or services subject to penalties for unlawful trade practices. It includes insurance for purposes other than personal, family, or household purposes in that definition. Makes technical language changes and declares an emergency and is effective on passage. The committee has before it a proposed Dash 2 amendment, which requires the approval of the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for rules established by the Attorney General with respect to conduct subject to the insurance code. Requires the Attorney General to provide copies of certain documents to the Director if an action relates to insurance, and prohibits a prosecuting attorney taking certain actions for unlawful trade practice related to insurance unless the Director requests that action.
So I'd like to bring up David Sugarman and Pat Allen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and Mr. Sugarman, I appreciate you making the trip here again. But I was hoping that you could walk through the Dash 2 amendment a little bit for the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby. Thank you. I'm David Sugarman. I am co-chair of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association Legislative Committee. Excuse me. 3160, upon introduction, there was legitimate concern raised about the longstanding relationship between DCBS and insurance companies. Insurance companies have been regulated through DCBS consistently throughout, and the concern, which I think was legitimate, was that if Department of Justice had jurisdiction as well, it might become confusing. Insurance companies might face a concern about, well, if I'm trying to comply with DCBS and DOJ is potentially passing other rules, where does that put me? So in consultation with DCBS, we have submitted the Dash 2 amendments, which clarify that DCBS remains in charge of insurance regulation, and that's both for rulemaking and enforcement. If DOJ is to take action to enforce under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, it must actually get the consent of the Department of the DCBS. And that's kind of the gist of it. I think I've hit it. And if you have any other questions, please feel free.
Questions from the committee, Mr. Sugarman? And Mr. Sugarman, where does that leave the private right of action for consumers under this bill?
Chair Holby, the private right of action is not affected by this. This is about the relationship between the departments of government. So the private right of action is maintained for consumers.
In the bill?
In the bill as originally drafted. There's no change.
Thank you. And Mr. Allen.
Chair Holby, members Welcome. Of the committee, Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Mr. Sugarman did a good job, I think, of expressing our concern, which was not to create parallel, similar, but not identical regulatory standards, whether pursued by different regulatory authorities, the Attorney General or the Department, or standards to be followed by companies, whether in dealing with consumers. And I think the Dash 2 amendments do a good job of working to address those concerns about not having parallel but dissimilar standards.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Lively, I'd take a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-25-13 to House Bill 3160 be adopted.
Representative Lively moves the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-25-13 be adopted to House Bill 3160. Discussion on the amendment? Objection to the amendment? Seeing no objection, the dash two amendments are adopted. House Bill 3160. Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3160 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 3160 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing any discussion? For the record, I do want to note that we did receive a letter of support of House Bill 3160 from Theodore Kulongoski. It should be in your OLIS, just in case anyone would like to see that. And was there anything else on the record for this?
Mr. Chair, I'll note that the measure has no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
No. Am I new on this? I'm a no. I need to change my vote.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Let the record show that Representative Smith is a no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3160, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. And Carrier?
This one was hard.
I'll carry this bill. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3160.
Aren't you nowhere here? Thank you, Mr. Chair, for accommodating me.
Oh, not a problem. No problem. Open a work session on House Bill 2929. Might have been premature to open that. Bob, give us a brief review of House Bill 2929, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2929 requires a trustee to pay certain penalties. Mr. Chair, there's a proposed dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2929, which significantly revises the measure. It removes the requirement that the trustee pay a penalty for failing to provide notice of new sale date, removes the requirement that the trustee pay a penalty if trustee fails to execute the deed to the purchaser, deletes the provision that a purchaser recording of deed perfects the purchaser interest at a specific time, changes the specific circumstances in which the trustee may rescind the sale, and requires specific notice of rescinded sale and refund to purchaser within specific timelines. That leaves in effect from the original measure the requirement that a financial institution, trust company, and title insurance company trustees maintain registered agents and registered offices continuously in the state in order to remain as trustees, Mr. Chair. The measure has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Representative Lively.
So Mr. Chair, I move dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2929, dated 3/19/13, be approved.
Representative Lively moves the dash 2 amendments be adopted into House Bill 2929. Those amendments are dated 3/19/2013. Discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, just a question about why we're removing that. Could we give a little background on?
We'll bring that discussion when
okay.
Back under the bill. Any other discussion? Is there an objection to adopting the amendment? Hearing none, the dash 2 amendment is adopted. And we will bring this bill back to move at a different date. So we'll have a little bit more time to have that discussion. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2929.
and a lot of patient people waiting. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3172. Bob, give us a brief description on House Bill 3172, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3172 requires evaluation of septic system of residential real property and a report of that evaluation to a buyer. It allows the buyer to withdraw an offer for property within 7 days of receiving the report and allows the buyer to revoke their offer if the seller fails or refuses to provide the evaluation report.
Great. Thank you. And I know I'd like to have the Department of Environmental Quality perhaps come up and speak to the bill if they're here. And up first, I have Angela Crowley Couch coming up after that. Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee. And if you could do us the favor of explaining the dash or the amendment to the bill, because I think it pretty much replaces the bill.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me Mike Kaczynski. He is the manager for our statewide on-site septic system program. And yes, Chair Holvey, we'll try to walk the committee through where we are. So Mike's got some written testimony that I would like him to share with the committee, but if I may, I'll try to take us to where we are today. So you have before you House Bill 3172. It's a bill that really has two components in it. The first component is it would require an evaluation of a septic system be part of a real estate transaction. The seller would have to supply that to the buyer, and there's some language in the bill about what that would entail. The other part of the bill is it amends the seller's disclosure statement, which is a required document in a real estate transaction. That statement covers a lot of the components of the property, and the component that we were focused on, the department was focused on, is the language in the disclosure statement about the septic system. And why we were interested in that is we're interested in making sure that buyers are aware when they acquire a piece of property that they have, or they know as much as they can, and the seller shares as much information as possible about the workings of the septic system, both from a functionality point of view and where the different components of the system are located. I think it's very common when real estate transactions take place for people to think about whether the tank, which is an important piece of the septic system, but not the only piece, whether that's working. But there's other components to the septic system that are important, the leach lines that carry the effluent out of the tank into the drain field itself. Those are all important components of the septic tank system. Mike's going to share a little bit why we were particularly drawn into this issue. It has to do with some rulemaking that we've been going through, and he'll share a little bit more about that. But with the assistance of Representative Holvey, we approached him about amending this bill. And this is why he asked me to explain the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment a bit, to change the bill so that it would no longer require at time of sale an inspection of the system. That part would come out of the bill. And so the bill would simply focus on the seller's disclosure statement and the series of questions that the seller has to answer so that the buyer is has as much information and can and make an informed decision about the property. And we are working with the Realtors Association, and I think they'll be speaking here momentarily about those questions that relate to the septic system and trying to arrive at a set of questions that are not such that sellers can't really answer them. They're not overly detailed that a person selling a property would be able to answer, but also the questions that would inform the buyer of what they need to know, what questions they should ask or information they should have in looking at the septic tank. And we're most interested in this to sort of wrap up here and like let Mike say, read his testimony, is that functioning septic tanks, and again, not just the tank, the entire system are important to dealing with non-point pollution that might otherwise come from that septic tank system. It's important to have that infrastructure work, and it should be important for buyers to know that when they purchase the property. And with good septic systems, we're going to have less public health issues and water quality problems. So that's how the department, in a nutshell, got involved in all this. And if I may, Chair Holby, I'll let Mike bring his testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, too.
For the record, my name is Michael Kaczynski. I manage DEQ's on-site septic system program. Okay, approximately 30% of Oregon households rely on septic systems to treat their sewage, and it's DEQ's responsibility to ensure that septic systems are installed and maintained and operated so that Oregon's land, public health, and water are protected. And improperly functioning septic systems can pollute streams and groundwater and cause a public health hazard by exposing people to raw sewage. So sometimes these problems are pretty obvious, as you might imagine, and at other times they're not. And so it's this reason that it's important to have systems periodically inspected by trained professionals. So DEQ began rulemaking last year to implement a mandatory time of transfer inspection program, and that was to actually begin this month in the coastal areas of the state. However, we encountered some hurdles along the way. And we did hear quite a bit of support for these rules, but we also heard about the concern for financial impacts to homeowners. Then with the passage of Measure 79 last November, which established a prohibition on new taxes or assessments on property transactions, DEQ was informed that we could no longer charge a reporting fee for time of transfer inspections. And that eliminated the funding mechanism to implement the inspection program, which raised the question of whether it would be worthwhile to require inspections when we would not have the resources to implement or oversee the program. So after considering the options, DEQ felt that a robust statewide voluntary approach would be the best way to go. So DEQ supports the comprehensive inspection. Comprehensive means the entire system, the tank, the drain field, any treatment units, all that is with the system. So a comprehensive inspection of the septic system at the time of transfer, as proposed in House Bill 3172. But as Palmer mentioned, our focus is on the amendments to the seller's property disclosure statement. And like Palmer said, we've been working with the realtors on amendments that we believe will help strengthen the statewide voluntary program by providing both seller and the buyer with more information about the system. So with that, I believe we'd like to, with Representative Holby's guidance, continue to work with the realtors on those amendments to the disclosure statement and then come back to the committee with an updated version of the bill.
And if you could briefly discuss or mention at least the importance of this kind of program with the impacts this has with the department and the state of Oregon with the federal EPA issues as well, and what that means to Oregon.
Absolutely. Chair Holby, there is a Coastal Zone Management Act that was established to protect the coastal areas of the state. And part of that is a non-point pollution control program. So if you have a program set up, then that makes you eligible for federal funding that can be used to address non-point pollution. And currently, recently we've been receiving, DEQ has been receiving about $2 million per year for the non-point program, and DLCD also received some funding, also about $2 million. So that would be in jeopardy if we don't have some type of a program that would inspect septic systems at regular intervals, or enough so that we can ensure that systems are properly functioning. Then that component could cause us to not be eligible for that funding.
And if I may, Chair Holby, This stems in part from the fact that the program has been conditionally approved by the federal government, the program, the Coastal Zone Management Program, and there has, well, there was a lawsuit that was a lawsuit filed against the EPA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. And as a part of that settlement agreement, in order for Oregon, the state of Oregon, to be fully approved, to have a fully approved coastal zone management program, we were required to address non-point pollution in our coastal areas of the state. And as a part of that, we had to look specifically at the issue of septic tanks. So that what the department initially pursued was rulemaking that would have required, as Mike mentioned, this required time of transfer inspection. We've since changed that approach, and we think the better way to go is an approach where we work, and we're working with the realtors to try to develop that program where there's more education and information to buyers and sellers at time of transfer so they can deal with the issues of whether the septic tank is functioning or not, and we take the state out of that. A key part of that would be the bill that Representative Holvey has here, House Bill 3172, and amending that bill to make sure that the seller's disclosure statement fully reflects the right set of questions so the buyer can think about those questions about the septic tank and be in a better position to make an informed purchase.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've got a coastal zone management plan or criteria, if you will, that's being handed down to us by the EPA. Is that correct? And we have to be in compliance with that as a state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, yes, if we want that approved.
Deals with non-point source discharges, is that correct, primarily?
Yes. Yes.
Septic tanks would be just one of what could be many non-point source discharges, though. Are we also dealing in the same way with agricultural runoff, with all the other, I mean, you guys know your business, but I'm assuming then there must be another concerted methodology for addressing the whole coastal zone management regarding EPA?
Right. I can answer that. Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, yes, the Coastal Zone Management Program is broader than just septic tanks. You're absolutely right. There are multiple sources of non-point pollution. This particular piece, or why there's so much interest in the septic tanks, is it was individually called out in the settlement between the organization that brought the lawsuit against the federal government.
Okay.
And that had, as again, the part of the settlement, the expectation was that DEQ would look to do a mandatory time of transfer program. We are instead proposing a voluntary program, building on the legislation, Representative Holvey's bill, and working with the realtors. And we're ultimately going to have to take that program and convince EPA and NOAA that that's sufficient to get federal approval for the larger coastal management program. Hopefully that sort of explains the sequence here.
So this bill, however, would impact septic systems throughout the state of Oregon, correct? Not just in the coastal zone management area.
That is true.
Even though we don't have that federal edict trying to tighten up regulations outside of that geographical region.
If I may, Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, that's a great question. It would be statewide. Quite frankly, we think that might be helpful in this case to approve a voluntary program with the EPA. I would also add, though, and it probably would surprise you, the coastal zone area is under this federal designation is quite large. It's not just a narrow band along the coast. In particular watersheds, it does travel a ways back. So it's really probably a solid third of the state. But again, you're right. The proposal here for the voluntary program is statewide.
Regardless of soil types and precipitation and climactic influences.
But again, it's all a voluntary program. It's simply just a voluntary program. That's why we thought maybe it would be appropriate to be statewide.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm curious if the state lacks such a program, does the federal government, besides the funding issue, do they come in and try to develop a federal program?
Chair Holvey, no, they do not.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you. I've read the bill. I just wanted to make sure if you could just verify all that this is doing is adding to the seller's disclosure sheet these questions that are listed in the bill relating to septic system, you know, location, age, pumping, has been pumped, and that the seller will say yes, no, or unknown, but that's all that this is doing, really.
Yeah, you represent Holvey, Representative Richardson, that is correct, and that would be in the form of the Dash 2 amendment. It would have those particular questions and exactly that. The seller would simply say yes, I know, no, I don't, or it's unknown.
Okay, so just after we adopt the Dash 2 amendments, there's nothing else in the bill that is being affected that affects the law. It's just essentially what the Dash 2 amendments are doing.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, thank you so much for explaining that much better than I think I could. Pretty sure of that. So thank you for your time. And up next to testify, I have, do I have any other supporters? John Chandler. Oh, he's, and Sean, would you like to come up as well? I know you're not on the list. Oh, Angela as well. There's three chairs. We'll let Angela go first, because I think she's more positive than the other two.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Angela Crowley Cook. I'm the legislative director at Oregon Environmental Council, and I provided written testimony, so I'll just sum up the highlights for you. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 3172, and the reason is because failing septic tanks are sources of high bacterial contamination that threaten public health and water quality around the state. And as you can imagine, it's hard for property owners to tell if their septic system is malfunctioning since they probably can't see it. And that's why these inspections at the time of transfer are very important, so that the homeowner knows if something's going wrong and there might be some pollution or contamination occurring. There are known problems with septic tank contamination around Oregon in the Lapine area, the Mackenzie River watershed, which is a drinking water source for the city of Eugene, in addition to the coastal communities that were addressed earlier. For these reasons, it's very important to ensure that septic tanks are periodically inspected so that we can prevent raw sewage from entering our rivers and our groundwater. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead. Or do we have questions of Angela first? I don't want her questions to get mixed up with...
I want to make her feel affirmed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Angela, is there any evidence that those microbes, which we could call certain things, are more prevalent in waterways now than they have been in the past, just from any data or evidence out there that you all might have regarding the Mackenzie or other rivers you've addressed?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you on that question.
Thank you.
And I don't know if it might be a question more appropriate for the DEQ to answer that question. I don't know if they have that information at hand or not. If they don't, they can certainly get back to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Long time no see. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. As you heard from DEQ, we are in opposition to the bill as drafted. However, we are working with them on amendments. I feel, actually, Mr. Chair, we've made substantial progress with the department on how we might be able to go forward with a voluntary statewide program. Getting back to Representative Johnson's question about the Coastal Zone Management Act, you all might be surprised to know that under that definition, Medford is coastal, and I think a lot of property owners there would be surprised to know they had oceanfront property. But that being said, I honestly, this has been a long process, obviously, and this particular bill has been before the legislature several times. We have had concerns each time dealing with the costs associated with these inspections and requiring them for many systems that are fully functional and do not have any evidence of deficiencies. That being said, the voluntary program as we move forward, I think you heard what the Dash 2 amendments, and we're still kind of working out the seller's property disclosure and what questions will be in there. But we are also talking with the department about a number of other proposals as well, including updating the buyers and sellers advisories, which we work with in conjunction with the Oregon Real Estate Agency, to have a more thorough section in there. There's currently about a paragraph talking about what a buyer and a seller should do. We're going to talk more about the actual components of a system in a more comprehensive check. We're also talking about continuing education for real estate licensees and a variety of other proposals. So I think there's a lot that can be accomplished either via rulemaking or just via agreement with our association and our members at the DEQ, but we would be supportive of tweaking the seller's property disclosure to add a few more questions. Currently, there's 10 individual questions on septic systems. Probably some of them aren't the most relevant, and so we're kind of working with the department to come up with what's the most important questions to ask, what would actually be known by the typical homeowner, because as you all know, the seller's property disclosure, every single question is a lawsuit waiting to happen for failure to disclose, and so we want to make sure that individual property owners have the knowledge necessary to answer the questions. I feel like we're making good progress with that, Mr. Chair. I'll stop rambling and answer any questions.
Thank you. And Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association. Positively delighted to be here in front of your committee again. We didn't think much of House Bill 3172 as introduced. Hearing about the Dash 2s, they sound like they're heading the right direction. From the new construction standpoint, we obviously don't like anything that gets in the way of people selling House 1 so they can buy House 2, which is we like to think a new house. This sounds like putting in the seller's disclosure, as Mr. Gillians and the department have explained, makes a lot more sense to us than a mandatory system, which would be a potential impediment and an extra expense in that real estate transaction. I look forward to working, looking at the Dash 2s when they're ready and come back at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean or John, has there been any thought to having, rather than a one-size-fits-all disclosure type of situation, regarding the age of the septic system in play here, i.e. you both know that the regulations for installation and stuff via DEQ regulations have been ratcheted up significantly, you know, in the last 20 years or so and even back beyond that. And, you know, to the point that, you know, in new construction, the county building department's going to have an as-built on record where the tank's located, where the drain field is, how many feet of drain field, what type it is, that kind of thing. And in a situation where an owner, seller, could provide that sort of information, that would alleviate them of a lot of that disclosure information. And then on the other spectrum, you get to the really old 1910 farmhouse where they probably can't even really locate where the septic tank is, much less the drain field, or if there is one. It's a different playing field is what I'm getting at. Is there any consideration at all to having some sort of delineation based on the age of the development in question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think we're attempting to get to that sort of situation with the amendments that we're talking about here, in that we're going to require more documents if the seller has them, such as an as-built, or whether or not it was installed with a permit in that transaction. So I think, honestly, you all have heard us 1,000 times say that Oregon's land use system of one-size-fits-all is terrible. In the seller's property disclosure, we actually kind of like it because it's a uniform set of disclosures that everyone deals with in the state, and you don't have different questions in different jurisdictions. It's kind of a uniform form that everyone uses. So we try and make it as general as possible. I think drilling down in these amendments will actually get more to your point, though, as additional information that a seller might have would be included in the transaction.
Thank you. And I hope in those discussions you keep in mind that, you know, at least for the state, you know, we have a great interest in having this program approved. And so as much as we water it down, we risk it not being approved. So just keep that in mind when you're having those discussions.
We're fully cognizant of the financial implications, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
A quick question.
Oh, Representative Doherty.
So basically the Dash 2s mean if I go and buy a house and it's got a septic tank, I will know whether a septic tank is awful or whether it is workable.
Right. And to clarify, we have Dash 1s right now. We don't have Dash 2s. They're imagining a Dash 2.
Yeah. Okay.
They're floating around here somewhere, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I think under current law, all of our members are advising folks to have an inspection at the point of sale. So, you know, if you were represented by one of our members, you as the buyer, we would suggest you should go have an inspection done before you purchase this house. And in fact, a lot of financial institutions require that before they'll lend money on the house. So what the difference is versus the original bill, bill would say that all sellers had to have it done no matter what. What we're working on now is clarifying more of the questions and increasing that awareness of consumers of the need to have an inspection done. And also, I think it's important to note, Mr. Chair, that point-of-sale mandates typically are very inefficient because our rural properties especially turn over at a very low rate. What we really want to do is educate homeowners who are actually in their properties using their septic systems on sort of best practices that they should be using in their rural properties, i.e., you know, don't hook up 19 different things to your septic, including a garbage disposal.
Use enzymes.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and I appreciate your willingness to work with the DEQ and trying to solve this issue for them and for consumers who I would think ultimately also should be aware of what's going on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill. We have more testimony on it? Uh-oh. Excuse me. Yes. We're not closing it. I didn't hit the go. Oh, geez, I never saw this page.
Yeah, they're going today.
A warning.
You have a track committee administrator, Mr. Chair.
We have a leader that could.
So I'm going to have to ask you to be very short and not reiterate, but can I bring up who's traveled?
We've all traveled.
From how? Coos Bay? Oh, my gosh. Richard Litz, Frank Gray, Mackenzie Litz. And can Richard testify for Mackenzie? Is that possible? Or
no, maybe I should say that different. Can Mackenzie testify for Richard?
Darn it. So if you can try not to reiterate and sum your, if you could really make it quick, I know your position on this, but I want you on the record.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Richard Litz. I'm the monitoring coordinator for the Ten Mile Lakes Basin Partnership. We're located in Lakeside, Oregon, which is between Coos Bay and Reedsport over on the coast. We are in that coastal zone that you've been talking about. I have emailed you written testimony, and I think Samantha is handy or
we've got it. So you don't need to read it to us. So
okay.
Just summarize what you want to say, because we've only got 5 minutes to get all these people in.
Okay. The consumer protection goes beyond the time of sale, the integrity of the system itself, the troubles that you're going to get into if the system isn't bad and you don't know about it is there's an expense involved in that. But there's also an expense involved in the septic system polluting the lake and leading to lower property values, to health issues and things like that. And I really want the committee to be really aware of that, and there's a reason that we're testifying today. Both North and South 10 Mile Lakes are water quality limited. The EPA 303D listed for both algae and weeds. There's been extensive research done over the past 15 years, starting with a phase one and phase two nutrient study, which was used by the EPA and DEQ to create a water quality management plan and a TMDL for a lake. I just wanted to give you a quick science lesson so you understand those charts that I'm have handed out. The first one, I want to show you the, and we'll focus just on the total phosphorus, which is in the upper left-hand corner there. Normally, phosphorus comes in from the watershed. It's a normal process. Plant debris, animal waste, and fertilizer stuff come down through the water system, the streams and stuff, into the lake. And the phosphorus levels increase in the wintertime as kind of flushes the system out. The weird part in our system and a lot of systems is you can see under June, July, and August, where the rains have stopped, there really is no input coming into the lakes. And so, but yet we're seeing our phosphorus levels go up. And that's the problem that is caused by the septic systems that we have in our area.
And we can see the same thing with the nitrogen and.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so, I appreciate that. I think that we can make sense out of your chart. It's pretty self-explanatory. If you could conclude your testimony so I can move on,
okay.
I would appreciate it.
I do think...
You are in favor of this bill, I might know.
As unamended with the number two amendment that they were talking about, I feel that that's watering it down, as you mentioned, and we really need something that's going to force people using a professional inspector to come through and look at a system. Now, I, as a homeowner there, really don't know what my system is doing, really. And I can check off the no or the I don't know, which is probably what most people would do,
right,
and which would accomplish nothing in the long run.
Thank you for that. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Frank Gray. I own a home on the lake and live on North 10 Mile Lake. I've been there for 19 years. I'm also a licensed contractor. And I've seen some of the problems. I care about the lake and the water quality, and I think people need the consumer protection that this would provide. My wife and I bought our place in 1993 and remodeled in 1994. If we would not have remodeled and got a permit to do it, we would or we could still have a system that would be out of compliance. And this is happening around the lake right now. But it still may work fine, draining effluent straight into the lake. I've heard about cabins that only have a pipe going into the lake. Yeah. So people who buy lakefront property coming from a city where they have a large city-ran sewage system, the only problems they ever have are just right in their homes. And they come to the lake, and as long as it drains, they think it's okay. They don't realize what's happening. They don't know what makes up a properly working system. And then, you know, to be a house in compliance, I don't think I need to go into how a system works now. That's been explained enough.
Right.
So,
and I appreciate your testimony and trying to shorten it up, because I really would like to get the rest of the people at least up to get their names on the record and their position.
I just want to say, please make people responsible, I think, and please include this septic inspection in House Bill 3172. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi. My name is Mackenzie Litz, and I'm 19 years old and also a resident of Lakeside. And I just kind of wanted to follow up on Frank Gray's statement about the lack of knowledge that consumers will have on this issue and how it will affect them. So personally, someday I hope to be buying a house, and I would have not considered the importance of the septic system. And especially coming from a bigger city, I would assume that all of these mechanics of the septic system are functioning properly. But discovering that this is potentially not the case is disturbing, not only for the immediate financial implications of repairing the system, but also for the environmental effects that Richard Litz was talking about. So just also the swimming and boating would definitely have the algae blooms would be threatening for the use of the lake, and they would have serious consequences for my future family's use of the lake as well as the future property values. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate your testimony. I apologize for having to be so short with you, but I do want to get these other people's names on the record for the bill. Up next, John Reese, Nick Workoven, Wade Sabik, and Scott Jacobson. And so I hate to tell you that you only have 1 minute apiece, and we have to vacate this room. And so I want to get your names and where you are on the bill, please. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, I'm John Reese. I am a lakefront business owner, also a lakeside resident, and a member of the Chamber of Commerce in Lakeside. I'm here just to briefly say that 2 years ago we had a lake advisory that was imposed on the lakes, and it was a significant impact to the city of Lakeside, the businesses, and of course those that are using the lake for recreational purposes. The specific problems that they had that year were very much related to the septic systems. They were localized to areas where there are septic problems going forward. And would just like to reiterate that I definitely support this. I think it's a step in the right direction to
protecting consumer safety, and also that consumer safety goes further than just the homeowner and that such, but the recreational users of our community, of our natural resources.
Thank you very much for that concise testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Nick Workhove, and I have a cabin on Lakeside. I'm an anesthesiologist, and I've been in practice in Coos Bay since 1974. My wife is a registered nurse about as long, and we have grandchildren. And I suppose you see in some of the documents that in a survey that was done in 2007, 19 out of 26 septic systems surveyed were in a state of failure. And the blue-green algae releases this toxin. And I have grandchildren, charming little girls, who are wildly enthusiastic about everything except going to bed. And they're in the water column, and I'm concerned for their safety. Every year you read in the newspaper about a dog that lapped up some water from a lake that's polluted with this blue-green algae and died. And my granddaughters are about the size of a medium-sized dog, and I worry for their safety and for the safety of everyone in the lake. And I would be in favor of the bill as unamended.
Thank you.
My name is Wade Savick. I'm a homeowner on 10 Mile Lake. Also, I'm a health care provider, so I have a very interesting concern in the public health and safety also. We bought our house about 6 years ago. It was a new construction, so I was confident the septic system was fully working, but I personally don't know that it was for sure because I'm not qualified to make that determination. The house originally used the water from the lake as a household water source up until 3 years ago. During one of the algae blooms, the water got to be so bad it would go through our very state-of-the-art water filtration system and chlorination. The water would sit in the toilet after you'd flush it, and it would look like somebody poured some tea in there.
We got the picture. And so, I appreciate your testimony. I want to get the last gentleman's name on the record because we do need to leave.
My name's Scott Jacobson. I'm a homeowner on 10 Mile Lake and the vice president of 10 Mile Lake Association. I'll jump to my summary. We represent the second largest lake in Oregon. In excess of 50% of the septic systems on the lake are guessed to be non-operating or non-existent. The EQ and the watershed people have been working on improving the situation through voluntary compliance for the last 15 years and have made little, if no, progress. Current state law says discharge of sewage into state waters is illegal. What we're here to is ask you to help us make the first step to enforce that law. Voluntary compliance has not worked, and they've tried it for many years. To be honest, I'm a little offended that the government regulatory agency is here with the realtors who buy and sell houses trying to water it down. I want to see you push hard. Solve
Thank
the problem.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
I appreciate your testimony. Again, I apologize for having to make it short. I did not see that long list buried here. So with that, we will carry this bill over because I didn't get through the testimony, and so there'll be another opportunity. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3172 and adjourn the meeting of the House Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Committee. Thank you.